Wonderful. Well, welcome everybody. It's my pleasure to say hello to those in the building and those online. If we haven't met before, my name is Alicia. I'm the Youth and Young Adults Pastor here at Inglewood. And I am a massive fan of The Office. You know, 6 years after the series finale of The Office, it placed number one as the top show watched on Netflix. There are many reasons for its popularity, but there's no denying that the bumbling regional manager of the Dunder Mifflin Paper Company, Michael Scott, pictured on the right here, is perhaps the star of the show. If you have seen the series, you would likely be familiar with his antics that he brings to his employees' daily lives. And his inept management, his constant unfeasible promises, his childish desire to be the centre of attention in every single thing that happens in the office, and his unwise decisions manifest into comedy gold. He is consistently calling his staff into meetings that derail because of his antics, and he calls impromptu parties, celebrations, and even interventions for his staff. Michael Scott causes more problems than he solves. And he is, in short, a complete and utter buffoon. An utter fool. And then we have characters like his competent colleague, Jim Halpert, featured on the left here, who often seems to break the fourth wall, giving bombastic side eyes and goofy grins to the audience as he thinks about and reflects on Michael's blunders. Similarly, the account of Nabal, Abigail, and David that we find in 1 Samuel chapter 25 records the antics of a fool, an utter buffoon, and how his wife, who is wise, is able to de-escalate a disaster through hospitality. This morning, we're exploring how remorse can be expressed through radical hospitality and the power that acts of hospitality and meals have to tear down the walls between people. And so in order to best understand how radical hospitality can sow peace in the midst of conflict, how it can help us to be reconciled, we're going to have a look at the three people in this account that the story revolves around. And while they are not the good, the bad, and the ugly, they are the fool, the wise, and the angry. I was expecting a lot more laughs for that, but never mind. I'm guessing that a lot of people don't watch The Office here. Nabal is the fool because he denies hospitality to the Lord's anointed and insults David. David is angry because of this slur, and he vows to destroy all of Nabal's house. And Abigail the wise is the one who intervenes, who takes the initiative, bringing a meal to David and his men. Her hospitality will save both her household from ruin and David from bloodshed. And so we open in 1 Samuel chapter 25 with the news that Samuel has died, the last judge in Israel. And all Israel gathers to the north in his hometown to pay their respects at his funeral. We're not actually sure if David is able to participate in this or not. Perhaps there is a temporary peace between him and King Saul. Or maybe there is not, but he then moves in the opposite direction, quickly to the south, to the wilderness of Maon. And we hear that there is a wealthy man in the region by the name of Nabal. He owns 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, and he is described as mean and crude in all of his dealings. Within our scripture today, Nabal is drawn as the fool because he refuses to show hospitality. And over our series so far, we haven't really talked about what happens when we deny hospitality. What happens when we refuse to share? And how does the Lord think about that? How does it reflect on us? Well, our scripture today shows that actually fools refuse to be hospitable. It's actually folly to not serve, to not give, and to not share. The story begins, we're told, at the time of sheep shearing. And sheep shearing was something that was done twice a year. It was a very festive occasion and a time where food and supplies were in abundance. This is not a time of drought. This is a time of plenty. It is the time where storehouses are overflowing and profits are being made and there are grand banquets and celebrations. And so David chooses an opportune time to come to a wealthy man who we actually find out he's been helping in the background. And David asks of this man that he might share some of his profit, that he might reward him in some gesture for the way that he and his men have protected Nabal's flocks and workers during times of Philistine raids. And he even encourages Nabal to go and talk to his workers to actually verify the truth of David's accounts. What's amazing is David doesn't specify the kind of gift he would like or the amount, but instead he doesn't come demanding that a debt be paid, like tributes to a king or a contribution to a general. He instead comes almost as a friend to another, asking for their blessing. But Nabal refuses to share any of the harvest abundance. And it's not like he doesn't have an abundance to share, because we learn later that he feasts in almost a gluttonous stupor. There is plenty for him, plenty for all. But it's not just that he denies the request, he actually verbally abuses David in the process, calling him an insignificant man not worth taking notice of. He says, "Who is this fellow David? Who does this son of Jesse think he is?" You know, even the Philistines knew who David was. There had been chants that went all through Israel. Saul has killed thousands, but David, tens of thousands. People knew his story. He was the one who saved them from Philistine oppression when he fought Goliath. He is not an unknown man. And yet, Nabal pretends not to know him and even insinuates that David is a bad man, a fugitive who should be reprimanded and not rewarded. He says, "There are lots of servants running away from their masters. Should I take my bread and my water and my meat that I've slaughtered for my shearers and give it to a band of outlaws, vermin, criminals, vigilantes, rebels? You don't deserve a drop." Nabal's remarks are insulting, offensive, demeaning. He has this knack of weaponizing information, twisting it to tell a different falsehood. And in times of stress and hardship, it's easy to let our anger loose, and this is what David does. Perhaps it's the fact that he has been on the run for so long and he is tired of the persecution and being called something he's not. Perhaps he's just really hangry because he's been in the wilderness and he can't get any food. Perhaps he's in mourning because his mentor, the man who anointed him to become king, has died and he will never see him raised. But for whatever reason, David is uncharacteristically angry at this point. Just a chapter ago, he saved King Saul from being assassinated by his own men. He told them that they would not take vengeance, they would not enact on the power, as Saul was right there for the taking. But in this instant, he is ready for blood. He is ready to rally his men and come with the full force and annihilate them. It might make us wonder, you know, how can Nabal be such a fool, such a blunderer, to stand in front of David and rile him up like this? Doesn't he know who he's talking to? Doesn't he know the army that stands behind David? Doesn't he know the stories of the Lord with him? This is not a man that you want to be on the bad side of. Being on his bad side is being on God's bad side. And all I can think is that it's a practice pattern of behavior. This isn't a once-off incident. This is the way that Nabal is with everyone, cruel and mean in all his dealings, refusing to listen to advice, refusing to share, refusing to care for anyone outside the pack, outside the inner circle, refusing to part with anything, even when there's more than enough, refusing even, if I were to point this out, we're told that Nabal is a Calebite, a descendant of Caleb. That means he's part of the tribe of Judah, the same tribe as David. They are kinsmen, not even willing to give crumbs to his kinsmen. You know, generosity is a muscle that we exercise. It's something that we flex. It's not something that in our culture we're naturally supported and encouraged to do something with. And so if we want to avoid the kind of folly that Nabal falls to, we actually have to exercise generosity. As we were here for the Busy Bee yesterday, I found myself looking at the sharing table and reflecting on everything that this table is, everything that we envisaged it to be. And I started to wonder, what does it look like if we were to arrive every week with a gift to add? I'm speaking more to myself, I realise, because my thinking is I'll just pull out the can of baked beans that I haven't touched in 2 years that's about to go off out of the pantry because I need to clear it out. But what would happen if instead I went to the pantry and I had a look at everything that was there and went, you know what, I bought 2 packets of pasta this week and it's my favourite. I bought 2 packets of crackers this week. They're my absolute favourite. They'll go in a day, but I want to share what I enjoy with someone else. And I brought that and I just said, I can get more. I can get more. What does it look like when we come to a sharing table and we exercise gifting, blessing, pouring out, opening our storehouses and saying, there is plenty for me and for you. You see, the wise use hospitality to make peace. we read that meanwhile, one of Nabal's servants went to Abigail and told her, you need to know what's going on and figure this out. Figure out what to do because there's going to be trouble for our master and for his whole family. And so we hear that Abigail takes action with immediacy. She doesn't wait to chat to her husband, whom no one can talk to. She doesn't wait for permission. She sees the writing on the wall and she takes action. She goes to those storehouses and she begins to pull out whatever she can that she doesn't have to give an explanation for, that she knows will go unnoticed, and she starts packing it up and loading it. 200 loaves of bread, 5 prepared sheep, 200 fig cakes, 2 wineskins, and the list goes on, and she sends it in the hopes that she might meet David before destruction comes. As she starts this sojourn with this line of donkeys of food, she meets David. He's up on the hill and she is in the valley, and she falls before him and says, I accept all the blame in this matter, my Lord. Please listen to what I have to say. Her initial moments with David are filled with respect. It's the opposite of her husband. And it's also an extremely unusual transaction for a woman to take in the Near East, the ancient Near East. In this interaction, Abigail shows what we would call the 3 elements of a genuine apology. That firstly, she understands the perspective of the wronged, and she uses this information to sow peace and empathy. She's able to reiterate to David his own story, that he is the one who slayed Goliath with the sling, that he has been good to his people, that he has been wrongly persecuted from Saul, and that this too is wrong. She is able to remind him that he is the Lord's and the Lord is with him. But then she also takes responsibility. She takes the blame by interceding on her husband's behalf. And I love that she doesn't say, excuse my husband. She doesn't pretend that what her husband has done is okay. She doesn't ask for him to be excused by any means. She actually accepts that what he has done is unforgivably wrong. In fact, she asks that David would overlook his foolishness because he's an idiot. And the blame that she takes is that, I'm sorry I wasn't there. I'm so sorry, David, that you had to deal with my dumb husband. If I had been there, this wouldn't have happened. You never would have been misunderstood. You never would have been sneered and shouted at. You never would have walked away empty-handed. You never would have questioned our support and loyalty. I'm sorry I wasn't there to make the difference. And thirdly, and most importantly, she serves David and his men by bringing food as what we call an offer of repair. This is considered the key part of an apology, the offer of repair. It is more than just saying sorry. It is enacting or actioning what the future will look like as a result of your apology. For some people, this is a promise to do better. For some people, this is maybe writing the apology out loud. For some people, it is reenacting an event, but this time you do the right thing, not the wrong thing. For some people, this is resupplying or restocking things that you have taken. But for Abigail, the offer of repair is twofold. It is the bringing of a meal, the gift that David first asked for, and it is the promise of support. Steve talked about, you know, it can be simple, but powerful. That it's not about the meal, it's about the conversation. And that is very much what happens here. When Peter and I were dating, no, we weren't actually, we were engaged. Woo. Let's move down the track there. We were going through marriage preparation. And we had this point in this marriage prep course where we got into an argument, and it was feisty. It was feisty. Ooh. I don't even remember what the heck the argument was about, but it was like there was this wall that got built between us. And I wasn't willing to move, and he wasn't willing to move, and it wasn't going to happen. We did not see eye to eye, and neither of us could agree on the other's position. And we had this really awkward moment, you know, sitting in the car and realizing that there was a wall and neither of us were moving. And I remember this moment, I think it was dawning on us, but at the same time, like, is this over? If we can't get past this, This is the end for us. And I remember sitting there thinking, like, is this the end? And still not willing to move. And then I heard Peter say these words. Alicia, we'll do what you want. I don't want to win. It broke me. Don't want to win. That wall crumbled in that instant. We were 100% back on track. And my biggest frustration in the moment was that I hadn't said it. How dare he be so wonderfully Christian? What a nice guy. Why do I have to be so stubborn? He floored me with grace. Often we would talk to those considering getting married, and we would say to them that the most powerful thing you can say in your marriage is, I'm sorry. Where do you need to make the first move and take the initiative? You know, Abigail hasn't wronged David, but she allows Nabal's sin and its consequences to be laid upon her. In her, we find something more stunning. It's a glimpse of our wise mediator who charged forward to face wrath on behalf of us foolish sinners. And as I think about Reconciliation Day, I often hear the comments, I wasn't there, I didn't do it. Why should I say sorry? Maybe our sorry is that we weren't there. Maybe our sorry is if we had, it wouldn't have happened. And we can offer a better future, one of repair. What does her hospitality do? Well, we learn that radical hospitality helps the angry turn from their own way to God's way. Abigail's intervention surprises David, but he also learns from her wisdom. He views her coming as a messenger from the Lord. the God of Israel. He says, praise the Lord, the God of Israel, who has sent you to meet me today. Thank you for your good sense. Bless you for keeping me from murder, from carrying out vengeance with my own hands. I'm just going to call up the band and ask you, who has the Lord sent to meet you on the road? David was about to do something he would have regretted if not for Abigail. And that's his realization as he is making his way to Nabal. You know, I think to myself, if anyone had been chatting to David and he had told them about the insult, about the offense and the way that he had been treated by Nabal, they would have said, you're in every right to have vengeance. You're in every right to be angry. You go and you slaughter that man and you wipe out his household. You have every right to do that. He's a bad man. But Abigail, that moment of initiative, that one meal, that intervention changes everything. She reminds David of a truth he's forgotten in the moment. Trust in the Lord, David. He will avenge you. He will take care of you. He will do things with your enemies. You don't need to. And it's in that moment that David just goes, oh, thank you. I was about to do something foolish. I was about to make the greatest mistake of my life. I was going to have blood on my hands, not blood that the Lord asked me to go, like blood because I wanted it. I was about to sin. David recognizes the voice of the good shepherd in his meeting with Abigail and is reminded of what it looks like to walk in the ways of the Lord and not his own way. Who are those voices in your life who remind you to walk in the ways of the Lord? That mentor that advises you how to deal with that marital problem and navigate family tensions. That voice of Christ in the colleague who offers insight into the office politics so that you don't get swept up in them. That voice of Christ in the friend who stops you from believing falsehoods and encourages you in your faith. That voice of Christ in the person who invites you to the table at Alpha or into a connect group. That voice of Christ in the Bible that halts you from sin. And where is God perhaps calling you to meet someone on the road, to take the initiative, to remind them of the Lord and his goodness and halt them from sin, or to say, I'm sorry I wasn't there. It wouldn't have happened if I was. This week, as we think on Reconciliation Sunday and what that looks like, let's pay attention to those who have gone unthanked, to those who have been mistreated, and those who deserve an apology. Thinking beyond our friends and our family to our nation, and what offer of repair we might bring. I'm going to give you a moment this Sunday to just reflect. Shell and Jeanette are going to sing a song called Common Ground. And what I love about this song is the way that it talks about how when we surrender our way and choose God's way, Jesus is able to tear down walls between us and show us a way of love, to bring us onto equal footing under the cross. And as we listen to this song, as it touches your heart, I want you to just ask yourself, ask Jesus, who are you calling me to make peace with? Who are you calling me to make peace with? I'll let them sing, then I'll pray.
Thank you, Leisha.